This week, our castaway is the actor and author Emlyn Williams. Emlyn, could you endure loneliness for a long time?
Not for a long time. No, I can be alone for a whole day, quite happily working. But I'm much happier if I think I'm going to meet some friends in the evening.
Is music important to you?
I have no understanding of music, and I can't sing. But I love music, and I've always used it in my plays. Sometimes even dragged it in, because I think it illuminates a play. Certainly to me it does.
What was your plan to musically illuminate your desert island? Are you looking back?
Yes, I think so.
What's your first record?
It's going back. It's, and will always thrill me, you know, even in the, on the bad days when it's pouring with rain and the sand is soggy, is when I was at Oxford, the first play I was ever had a part in, and it was at the New Theatre, Oxford, the first theatre I'd ever acted in, and we did Peer Gynt. And I'd never thought of music. I didn't really know about Grieg. And when we got to the dress rehearsal, all the thrill of the lights and everything, and suddenly this orchestra started to play in between the scenes, ready for I was walking on, doing all sorts of six or seven parts. The thrill of being on that stage, and I knew that, I thought, nothing's going to stop me staying here on this stage, only with bigger parts. And that's the it would always thrill me on the island. I would feel that creepy thing at the back of your neck, you know, mm-hmm. when you hear this marvellous dramatic music. Noel Gibson must have been thrilled when he first heard it.
In the Hall of the Mountain King, from Grieg's Music to Peer Gynt, Sir Thomas Beecham conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Let's go on to your second record now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm afraid it's unashamedly ego-centric, because it's a tune, an old Welsh folk tune, which I used in a play of mine called The Corn is Green. I'd heard this music as a child, sung in my village, and I had the feeling I can say it now. I couldn't have said it then because I was so superstitious. I felt this is going to be a success. It was the music that told me, not my words, yes. in the dialogue. And that's why I would always love to have this with me.
And indeed, the play was a success. And what is this tune called?
It's called Bigeiliar Gwenith Gwyn. Bigail is the Welsh for shepherd, so it really means shepherding the corn.
And which choir shall sing it?
It's the Pontardilais male choir, one of the best.
Shepherding the Corn, sung by the Pontardilais Choir.
Pontardilais.
Pontardilais.
Excuse me.
I beg your pardon. Yes. Must brush up my Welsh. I've been saying that for years.
All right. You're forgiven.
What part of Wales do you come from, Ernest?
Flintshire.
Yes. Your first language, of course, was Welsh.
Yes, until I was, well, really, until I was about eight or nine, and I learned English really on the side, and, of course, at school did it. But, of course, talking Welsh at home all my English was out of books. It was the printed word.
There is, of course, in Wales no theatrical tradition. There was no theatre for you to see.
No, none. Except the preachers, of course, who would have died if they'd been called theatrical. But they were, looking back, there were some of them were very, very fine and very crafty actors.
Yes. You were a bright boy. You won scholarships. You were sent abroad. And you won a scholarship to Oxford. What did you read there?
French and Italian. Because, you see, I'd been sent when I was 15 by my teacher, Miss Cook, which was very far-sighted, over to a little village school in Haute-Savoie to a friend of hers, and there was not one word of English spoken there, so I just had to speak French, mm-hmm. however difficult it was for me, for 3 months, literally every day, all the time, which was marvellous, of course, preparation for going for a scholarship in French.
Yes. As an actor, what was your first major opportunity?
On the spot. By Edgar Wallace.
Mm. Yes, you played the Italian gangster.
Angelo, yes, marvellous part. But you could never have known it was a marvellous part to see it because it was so short. And gradually I realised it was one of those golden parts that every line tells and it's terribly effective.
Yes, and then you followed it with another Edgar Wallace.
Yes, the case of the Frightened Lady. I had to play an Indian army officer, which I tried to convey that I was not the ordinary run of Indian Army officer, that I was a slightly round peg in a square hole, and just to so that people wouldn't say, well, I've never seen an Indian officer like that. I mean, I don't think I looked freakish, but I wasn't the Pukka Saab, you see.
Yes. What sort of man was Edgar Wallace?
Oh, he was a fascinating, larger-than-life man.
Larger-than-life?
Yes. And my father, of course, was thrilled because my father was slightly a racing man, you know, with the pools and the pennies. And he was thrilled and really much more by him as a racing man and an owner of horses than as a playwright.
Let's have another record. What's number three?
It's called The Entrance of the Little Fawns. And it's a tremendously merry tune. I love it.
Entrance of the Little Fawns by Pierre Ney, the Pro Arte Orchestra conducted by Gilbert Vinter. Now, you told us that your first acting successes were in the two thrillers by Edgar Wallace. As a playwright, your first two successes were thrillers.
Yes, one was called A Murder's Been Arranged. It had an extraordinary sort of success on a Sunday night, which wasn't absolutely carried out in the week. It has been slightly overpraised. I mean, and it's been done tremendously by amateurs and repertory companies. But the next one was the one that really was very lucky to be Nightmare's Fall.
Yes,
and both murder plays indeed.
It was that murderous boy with a head in the hat box.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Well, now came a long and very satisfying period for you, during which you starred in your own plays. Now, the one in particular which you mentioned, The Corn is Green, was autobiographical.
Yes, it was really biographical almost more because it was about my teacher, Miss Cook, who'd taught me. And, of course, I placed it much earlier. I placed it in 1890.
Yes.
I was at school, you see. I was 10 in 1915, 16. And, of course, education in Wales was by then much less picturesquely undeveloped. Mm-hmm. So I had to throw it back to 1890 to make the boys whom she was trying to teach. They were minors already at the age of 13, as I of course wasn't happening in 1916. but it's very much her character completely.
Yes. She was played by...
By Sybil Thorndike, and then Ethel Barrymore in New York, and then Bette Davis played the film.
Mm-hmm. Now, what other plays shall we talk about of those years? The Light of Heart was a great success.
Yes, that was done in the war, that's right. With Angela Baddeley and Godfrey Tell.
Yes, and The Morning Star about...
That was a play about the Blitz. That might be interesting to see it now because it was such a period piece.
And The Wind of Heaven?
Yes, that was just at the end of the war. It was a play about, if the new Messiah had arrived, or there was somebody who was supposed to be the new Messiah, had arrived in a little Welsh village.
The time for another record, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I'd like to have, as I've always dealt in the spoken word and the written word, I'd like something funny. Peter Sellers and Irene Handel. I think I would be laughing or at least smiling through the worst weather.
Yes. Well, this is the lady who meets the French gentleman.
Yes,
the
it's when they're sitting on a bench in the park.
I was just going to ask you back to Dindley's when we...
Well, I would love to come. Please ask me.
A smashing table at the Royalston, you know. We nearly always have a second vegetable and always croutons with a soup. And if you ever feel like having half a bottle of Bordelais, they practically fall over themselves backwards bringing it in for you. I always say, as long as there's enough to see me out, what happens afterwards, it's sans rien.
Oh, you speak French.
Un petit peu.
Oh, but you have got a very fine accent, you know.
Oh, your blue eyes.
Irene Handel and Peter Sellers in The Sketch, Shadows on the Grass, which was written by Irene Handel.
I think I'd be smiling for quite a long time over that, don't you?
I'm sure you would.
Chuckling, even.
In 1951, you had an idea for a one-man show. You reenacted the readings which Charles Dickens gave in later life from his own works. What gave you that idea?
But it happened out of the blue. It was extraordinary. I was asked to be in one of those all-star things on Sunday. You know, it's something that changed the whole course of my life. I was reading a biography of Dickens by Una Pope Hennessy, and she was talking about these marvelous success he had with these. They weren't readings, they were real performances, extraordinary solo performances and scenes. So I thought, well, as a lark, I'll try get myself up as him. And coming on for 8 minutes, 10 minutes, and do a thing from Bleak House, not even dialogue, but descriptionist, because I knew his wonderful powers of description were really dramatic, you know, quite apart from the printed page. And it had such an effect on the audience that I thought, well, I think I'm onto something. And I worked on it for a year, finding the various items for a whole evening. What gave me confidence was I knew that the one thing I had to have was variety. Ghost stories in between and satire and irony and fantasy and... he's got absolutely everything. Mm-hmm. So I knew if I could live up to that, I would be all right.
Yes. In how many countries have you portrayed Charles Dickens?
Oh, I think everyone now, except the moon, I think. You can call that a country. I don't think I'd get very good houses there, do you?
No, it's a terrible theatre territory.
I want to get back to that desert island, don't you think? No, I've done everything. I did South America, which was the last... I tell you where I haven't been, which I would love to go. And it's always on the point of going, which is China.
Mm-hmm.
There was talk of Peking about 2 years ago, but it couldn't be fitted in. I've been to Japan.
Any idea how many performances you played?
Oh, about... I've played a few more than you've done at Desert Island. I think I beat you by about 200 or 300. I've done about... Well, now I've got Dylan Thomas as well, you see. So
yes.
Dickens, I think, is a little over 2,000. On and off, you see, for 23 years.
Mm-hmm.
I was the last attraction, if you can call it that, at the Ambassadors when the Mousetrap came on. It's true. But I haven't been... In this, ever since, continuously, I hasten to tell you, because I'd have gone mad by now. I'd have been in a mousetrap of my own. I've always been able to get away from it and do it. I've never done it for more than 3 or 4 months at a time, and done things in between, and I come back to it fresh.
And you're playing Dickens again at the moment at the Theatre Royal Haymarket.
Yes, well, of course, I've never played before. It's the only theatre in the West End I had never played. And then after that, I go on quite a long tour, which I love doing in England and Wales, and... to America in the fall, they say.
Dickens has, in a way, taken over your theatrical life since 1951, apart from a season at Stratford, and you took over from John Gielgud in 40 Years On. You've done very little acting.
Not a great deal, no. I've really somehow got into writing three books, and of course three substantial books. I mean, I'm not saying that as a praise, but I mean that they're long. You know, they've taken an enormous amount of trouble to write, and they took about 3 years each. Well, that's 9 years, mm-hmm. you see.
Two very honest volumes of autobiography, George and Emlyn. Then your third book about those appalling Moore's murders.
Yes.
You sat right through the trial, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and there are moments when I wish I hadn't. You know.
You've always been fascinated by the macabre.
Yes, but it's always been second hand until that. And, of course, when I got to that, that was the real thing. And I it's really made me feel I never want to go back to it. Cured me.
Yes. Now, recent events. You've turned The Corn is Green into a musical.
Mm-hmm.
Miss Moffat.
Yes, and it was done in America in the autumn. And it did work, too. But, of course, we had to stop in the second week because Betty Davis, who was the main attraction, of course, fell ill, and we had to just fold.
Yes, but it's coming back.
I think next summer, yes.
And you have ideas for another musical?
Yes, I'm now halfway through it. It's a musical of a play that I wrote about the Globe Theatre in Shakespeare's time called Spring 1600.
Yes.
John Gilgold directed it originally. And I suddenly thought, well, I'd try my hand at this, because it, to me, lends itself. It's about a girl who joins the company dressed as a boy and then plays Viola. They all think she's a boy, because all that is, to me, great fun for a musical, and using all the costumes and the pageantry, and hope it works.
Mm-hmm. Both your sons have followed in a footstep, one as author and one as actor.
Yes, yeah, sounds as if I've only got one leg.
No, two.
Yes,
two
one, yes, one, and needless to say, they've never had any pushing, you know, from either their mother or me to go. They wanted whatever they wanted to go, that's where they should go. No, but they went up there, and of course, the elders is a novelist of growing repute, I'm very proud to say, and he's got a book out, just out now, which is fascinating, about Philby, called Gentleman Traitor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the sixth or seventh book. I'm allowed to publicise my son.
Of course you are.
And the other one is in films, an actor, and in films. He's in films at the moment, and he's on the production side of films. Brooke mm-hmm. Williams, he's filming in Nice at the moment with a quiet, shy, retiring character called Richard Burton.
Oh, yes, yes, I've heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have record number five.
It's London Pride by Noel Coward, because I absolutely worshipped his talent. That's not too strong a word. Gracie Fields is singing. Marvellous, touching singer, funny, and everything a star should be.
Early rain and the pavement glistening, all Park Lane in a shimmering gown. Nothing ever could break or harm the charm of London town.
Gracie Fields. And straight into record number six. What's that?
It's called A Shropshire Lad, and I know I would love hearing it.
George Butterworth, A Shropshire Lad, the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. Now, the practical side of being a castaway, Emlyn, could you look after yourself?
No, I would be absolutely hopeless. I'd be just be mooning around on that sand, just listening to records.
Have you done anything like fishing?
No.
Or cultivating?
No. Like, I was a country boy, but I was a country boy who couldn't wait to get out.
Would you get out of the island? Would you? Can you escape? Do you know anything about...
I can swim, but not that far.
No, small boat.
If there was a small boat?
Could you make a small boat? Could you make a raft?
You'd have to have a knife, wouldn't you?
Shells?
You'd cut with shells. Oh, yes. I might, with that sort of ingenuity, I might get at, but I would be very, very bad craftsman.
But I think you're getting quite excited at the project.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm still waiting.
Right, record number 7.
This is a music which I've only been introduced to in the last 5 or 6 years, having a little, well, it's called a villa, but it's really a tiny little house by the sea in Corfu. Buzuki music, you know, marvellous. It's nostalgic music in itself, and yet with a wonderful rhythm and a deep-seated sort of gaiety in it, and a deep-seated sadness too, which is to me the best of that sort of music.
You haven't given us the title.
Well, it's... you don't mind if I show off my Greek, do you?
But please.
It's called Chorisame Enadirino, which means we separated, we parted one evening.
Hadjidakis' tune, We Parted One Evening, from the long player Lilacs Out of the Dead Land. Which brings us now to your last record.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's Elizabethan Serenade, and I think you'll get the idea of him, thrill of pageantry and drama and challenge. It's marvellous.
Elizabethan Serenade, played by Ron Goodwin and his orchestra. If you could take one disc out of your 8, narrow it right down.
The Elizabethan Serenade.
Right. And one luxury?
Well, I hope would I be allowed a typewriter? And paper and pen, of course.
Right. And one book, apart from the Bible, Shakespeare, and big encyclopedias.
Am I allowed a big dictionary?
Yes.
Ah, well, that's what I take, because, you see, I've always been... Nothing can cure it. Fascinated by words, the what you call computations, the
permutations
would be endless, and it would also help one to write. One would learn new words and improve oneself while waiting for that sail on the horizon.
Yes. And thank you, Emlyn Williams, for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Oh, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Goodbye, everyone.